Revenue Chat episode 99. The Dream Business community wants to help you with your career and business. Are you ready for accelerated success? Check it out. The Dream Business community at tonydurso.com/community. John Mautner, the founder of Cycle of Success Institute, is a seasoned entrepreneur who launched and built 4 successful companies in the past 20 years. Inc. magazine named his first business as one of America's 500 fastest-growing companies. Now, John tells us the top 10 tools for building a profitable high-growth business. Next on Revenue Chat. Hello again and welcome to this episode of Revenue Chat. Wasn't last week's episode 98 with Russell Brunson incredible? What a breathtaking tour of behind the scenes. Now we all know how to really do online sales using funnels to generate large revenue streams. And can you imagine making $1 million in sales your first year out of college? That's insane. I hope you're all putting this to great use for your future. Now we have another mega giant in the industry. With us, we have John Mautner, founder of the Cycle of Success Institute, COSI, also pronounced as COSI throughout this interview. In 2001, John founded COSI with the intention of providing small and mid-sized businesses with a practical business education program. Since then, COSI has educated and coached over thousands of graduates in the Midwest. As a sign of appreciation for all that COSI accomplished to grow businesses that grow communities, Governor Pat Quinn named March 16th COSI Day in the state of Illinois. His website is learncosi.com. That's learncosi.com. All right, Revenue Crew, let's rev it up. Get ready for John to show us the top 10 tools for building a profitable, high-growth business. Here we go. Hello, John. How are you?
Tony, I'm doing great. How are you, my friend?
I'm doing fine, and I want to thank you and tell you that it's really great to have you on this interview, and I really appreciate you taking the time out of your busy work day to hang out with us on Revenue Chat.
Well, you know, anything I can do to help the show, and I'm delighted to be here, and it's an honor, so thanks for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. It's always great to interview a fan, and I want to thank you once again. All right, John, I did mention a little bit about you and COSI, COSI, and perhaps you'd like to fill us in a little more on your roots and how you became an expert in your field. John, how did it all start for you?
Well, you know, it's funny. I was in my mid-20s, and I was working for a Fortune 500 company, and I went to get a degree in accounting and finance. I don't even know why, because I don't like accounting and finance, but at the time, it sounded pretty cool, so I ended up working for this, you know, multinational conglomerate, and I quickly realized, you know, that's not the kind of environment I really want to see myself. For some reason, I could see flash my life in front of me, and 30 years from now, I would get a gold watch and things were sucking the life out of me, and I would end up basically in that situation. It just wasn't kind of, for some reason, in my mid-20s, I saw that as a life I didn't want to lead. So I quit my job and I decided to start my first company. Now, granted, having said that, I had absolutely no entrepreneurial background. I had no experience running a business. I had no money. I had no connections. But I had a dream and vision is probably the only thing I really had. And I had this crazy idea that I wanted to go sell roasted almonds and pecans on a cart. So I bought an actual copper kettle. I imported this candy-making kettle from Germany. And ever the last dime I had in the world to buy the thing. And I always enjoyed candy making. So I added cinnamon, sugar, vanilla, and some other ingredients. And I would turn the flame underneath the copper kettle, and the smell of the cinnamon would fill the air. And I decided I'm going to take this idea, and it's a concept that I don't really see anywhere. It's kind of a niche, and I'm going to put it on a cart, and I'm going to have an umbrella, and I'm going to quit this good-paying job. I'm going to go sell roasted almonds and nuts. on the side of a street corner. And of course, all my friends at that point said, you know, you are nuts. Okay. I mean, you've got a good job. You're lucky to have this job and, you know, you should jolly well keep it. And I'm like, no, this is not something I want to do. So I didn't get a lot of support when I began my venture as becoming an entrepreneur. But I opened up my first location in Orlando, Florida, at a small downtown kind of outdoor shopping center called Church Street Station. And within about 6 months of my dream and vision of global domination, of having roasted nut carts all over the world, because that was my vision. It's like, I think there's someday going to be roasted nut carts all over the world. I was actually completely convinced of this fact. In fact, it's all I could think about. But after about 6 months of being in business, I was pretty much out of business. I was functionally bankrupt. You know, I was 3 months late on my rent, and the mall manager was a nice guy, but he was getting a little impatient. And I was just like barely making enough money to survive. I mean, $50 a day in sales wasn't going to cut it. And I had many days when I was doing less than 50. And if I did $100 in a day in sales, I would be excited. But at the end of 6 months, it was sort of like, you know, what am I going to do here? And I was really at a crossroads. And I sort of decided that, you know, I could go back and get a job somewhere, but or I could figure this problem out and try and make this work. So I used the process of elimination. I said to myself, okay, what's wrong with this situation? You know, why is it that I can't make a go of this thing? So I said, well, is the product bad? And the answer is no, because people like the product. I mean, is the cart ugly? And no, it looked good. You know, is the hair parted on the wrong side of my head? I mean, I went through a laundry list of things that, you know, what could be wrong with this situation? And it really came down to simply, I just don't have a good location. I'm not getting enough traffic flow, and I have a serious problem here. So I decided to move from that location, and I called the Orlando Arena. Now, the Orlando had just built this beautiful arena, and they just got an NBA franchise called the Orlando Magic. And Shaquille O'Neal, you know, and is known as the Shaq, was their big star at the time. And so I called the food service director at the arena, and I said, look, you know, I've got these roasted nut carts. I'm selling a cart at Church Street Station, downtown Orlando. And I wanted to see, maybe it'll sell at the arena. I know you're selling peanuts, but this is kind of a gourmet product. We make it fresh on the cart. The smell of the cinnamon fills the air. It's a gourmet almond and pecans. And he goes, you know, kid, I got to tell you, I'm really busy. Why don't you send me a brochure and a sample, and I'll get back to you. Now, I don't know what came over me, but I just simply said, most people probably would have said, okay, I'll send it to you. But I figured if I did that, the product would be cold and the brochure would probably sit on this desk for a month and nothing would happen. And it wouldn't be the best possible presentation that I could make. So I said, well, you know, I'm going to be in the neighborhood tomorrow, so I could drop by and maybe bring some samples to you. And he goes, yeah, that sounds good. Come over in the morning. So I only had one shot. So I instead of just bringing a bag of almonds that I made the night before, I actually took my old pickup truck and I loaded up the cart and I rolled it into the back loading dock or the Orlando Arena and I plugged it in because I wanted to, you know, I only had one chance and I had to make the best impression. And so the smell of the cinnamon was filling the air and this big garage door opened and people from the food service company and the Orlando Magic team members came out and everybody was crowding around the cart and I was giving out samples and he could, so they could see what this is all about. And he goes, this is really cool. You start tomorrow. So my very next day at the Orlando Arena, I opened up and I did about $3,000 in sales and I couldn't make them fast enough. I was slammed. It was crazy. It was like I'd found the right product and the right type of location and everything changed from there. I was able to save enough money and I went to the Universal Studios theme park and I was able to get a cart in there. And then I went to Disney and I was able to get a cart in there. And because Orlando is an international city, 30 million people from around the world go to these theme parks and visit Orlando, people would see the cart and they go, this is really cool. I'm from, you know, Sao Paulo, Brazil. How do I get one of these carts? Or I'm from London, England. How do I get one of these carts? And I'm from, you know, Jamaica. How do I get one of these carts? And so people would approach me every day and say, this is really cool. How do I get one of these? So I built a kind of a franchise system. And I could help others get started, find the locations, make the product, get things rolling. And again, the dream I initially had is someday there'll be roasted nut carts all over the world. And what happened is over the next 5 years, I had roasted nut carts all over the world. In every continent, hundreds of locations were open. And the company did in excess of $100 million in revenue over the next previous 5 years. And the company became one of the 500 fastest growing companies in the country. all from really kind of just focusing on my dream and vision of someday there'll be roasted nut carts all over the world. So I'll think a lot about what I think about is that things can happen if you believe they can happen. I think people are where they are in their business lives because that's actually where they truly want to be, whether they'll admit it or not. So I kind of subscribe to the philosophy of being a positive thinker. The glass is always half full. Things can happen. And I think that positive energy has really helped me along the way. And so what I did is about 15 years ago, I was able to sell the company. And people would always ask me, John, you know, how did you build one of the 500 fastest growing companies in the country? I mean, we tripled in size every year for 7 years. And how did you do that? And I said, well, I've got a philosophy and I've got a formula and I do certain things every day that make it work. So people would say, well, can you show me? And I said, yeah. So I started coaching other companies on how to do this. And I actually turned it into a business where I now work with entrepreneurs around the country of how to really build profitable, high growth companies. I've been very fortunate to work with over 4,000 different owners and managers of all kinds of different companies, from construction to manufacturing to service to architects to engineers to you name it. You know, almost every type of company has utilized this program to be highly competitive and highly profitable. So that's sort of my story, a little bit about how I sort of became an expert in really coaching companies how to build profitable, high growth companies.
Wow, John. Wow. That's all I can say. I'm speechless. I don't know what, I'm in awe. That is an incredible story. I didn't know about the nut cart, but I did know that you had one of the fastest growing companies on the top 500 list. I just didn't know all the details. I am totally in awe. That is an incredible story.
I appreciate that, Tony. I really do. And thank you very much. It was not always easy. There were many times when we were growing so fast that if we weren't careful, we could actually grow ourselves out of business. And we came close to the edge a few times. And, you know, that teaches you some lessons on how to really, you know, grow carefully and in a way that makes a lot of sense. And I think if you're not growing, you're kind of dying. And I think a lot of businesses languish. You know, the problem we're having right now is that there's about 28 million small businesses in the country, and about 10 million of them are not growing, and they're hanging on really just sort of barely making it. You know, they're paying the bills, but they're not growing. And imagine what we could do if we could take those millions of companies and just get them to start using some tools and techniques that might help them grow their businesses. They might hire more people. They might be able to expand and help their business. You know, their communities are growing because their businesses are growing. So a few years ago, the governor of Illinois named March 16th COSI Day, which COSI is the Cycle of Success Institute, which is the coaching program. And because of all the companies we've helped in Illinois save jobs and create prosperity and keep companies alive when otherwise they may not be. So it's fun to be sort of be able to do something positive to help other fellow entrepreneurs grow. And it's really become a passion of mine. And I'm growing and expanding this model around the world. And it really does work. And it's really simple what I do, but really effective.
Very cool, John. And I got to tell you, I feel the audience on my back right now. They're like, let's cut to the chase. We want to know this important information. So if I could just dive right in, John, and say, let's get into the top 10 tools to building a profitable, high-growth business. I guess start with how you discovered it, and let's just kind of jump into it, please.
Sure. So what I did is I've worked with, you know, a lot of different companies. I look back to the last 100 companies that I'd worked with. These are all different companies in different industries, you know, small businesses, mid-sized companies. And I looked at the last 100 that I coached to really help them get things on the right track and really grow faster. And what I did is I started asking, I use an approach that I call voice of the people. So when I walk into a business, I gather a team of the employees together. If it's a 10-person company, we get the whole, you know, 10 people together. If it's a 100-person company, we grab 10 people from different departments, different disciplines, and different backgrounds. Kind of a global view of the business. I call it a dream team of experts. And I say to the dream team of experts when we're gathered around the conference room table, when I start working with them, I say, you know, honestly, I don't know anything about your business. And they look at me like, well, how's that possible? And I said, well, I don't know anything about your business because I don't work in your business. I'm not there every day, year after year, day after day. You are. I mean, you have that technical knowledge on what it takes to really, you know, grow your business. You've got technical knowledge and day-to-day insight, deep insight into the organization. So I want you to really work with me to come forward with what you think is the most critical things we could do right now to improve the company. So for the last one, each of these 100 companies, when we did the process of asking voice of the people, what do you think we could make better? What's a challenge you're having? What's a really cool creative idea that we can implement right now that'll make a difference to the company's success? Each of these 100 companies identified 100 things. So that's 10,000 things I've seen with these last 100 companies. Then what I did to each of these 100 companies, I said, okay, out of those 100 things you identified, what do you think is the top 10 most important things that we could do right now to improve the company? And what was interesting is the top 10 most important things were almost identical across these 100 companies. It was really a weird phenomenon. It was like a broken record. It was deja vu. I'd walk into one company and the top 10 were identical to the next one and the next one and the next one. It might be a construction company is identical to a manufacturing company as it is to a law firm. It's just interesting how the top 10 things kept coming up over and over again. So what I did is I actually wrote a book about it. So it took me about 8 months to write the book. The book came out in March of 2016, and in 24 hours, it became the number one best-selling business book on Amazon. And I think that's because people are interested in what are these common denominators that all companies face, and what are they, and what can I do about them? And it was really surprising, but that's what happened. So, you know, I'd love to share maybe what those top 10 things are.
That would be fantastic, please. The Dream Business community wants to help you with your career and business. As you know, jobs can be fickle. Here today, gone tomorrow. And owning a business has its own frailties. Bloomberg says 8 out of 10 entrepreneurs fail in the first 18 months. A Harvard study says 3 out of every 4 venture-backed firms fail. And there's other sources with shocking figures of their own, which all point to one very conclusive point. These are scary times we live in. Let's help you in the Dream Business community. Yes, you. Let's try to give you the information you need now to boost your career or business. And I'll be there every step of the way, helping you along with other experts in many industries. Are you ready for accelerated success? Check it out, the Dream Business community at tonydurso.com/community. That's tonydurso.com/community. And we're back with John Mautner talking about top 10 tools to build profitable high-growth business.
Okay, why don't I run through them all, and then I'll take them one at a time, and maybe we can chat about them for a little bit. Is that a good idea?
That's great also, please.
Okay, so the first one that came up all the time, and these are in no particular order, but there was no formal sales process, which means that every salesperson out there did it their own way, did it differently. There was inconsistent quality. In fact, again, people were doing things differently all the time inside the same company. So a lot of lack of quality was happening. There was a lack of what's called standard operating procedures. And a standard operating procedure is a written document of how you greet the customer, how you set the machine up, how you turn the knob to the left, and so on and so forth. So everybody does it the same way. There's a lack of scheduling problems. So scheduling became a real issue. Poor inventory management was another one that came up. Estimating and bidding errors, because if you can't bid it right, then you might be setting yourself up for failure. Tight cash flow was an ongoing commonality amongst all the 100 companies. And lack of proper project management. How do we run projects successfully? Communication problems came up all the time. That made it to the top 10. And the final one is lack of innovation. You know, how do we get things really become more innovative in our companies, and I'll talk about maybe how to start doing that. So those are the top 10. So should I pick the first one and maybe chat about it a little bit, which is no formal sales process?
Absolutely, John. Please, yes, let's do it.
Sounds good. So, you know, it's interesting how people sell products or services. And what I find is that it starts usually with, you know, what is our messaging? You know, is it compelling? Is it something that gets people really excited about what you're doing? And often, you know, if you're in an elevator, the famous elevator pitch, right? You got 3 minutes. You're in the elevator with somebody that potentially could be a great customer of yours, and they say to you, "What do you do?" You know, in the next 3 minutes, by the time you get to the 25th floor, you got to say something that gets them to want to learn more, want more, really feel connected to you. And that's often that message that's resonating is usually very inconsistent. You know, imagine you put 5 of your people around the table and you go, "Okay, we're in an elevator. Tell me what you do. Tell me what you do. Tell me what you do." You'll get 5 different of these types of messages that go out, which is really a problem. Not only just does it begin with the messaging process, but, you know, sales actually is a process. You know, it could be that we meet the customer and then we put together a bidder estimate and then we send the bidder estimate to the customer. It might be a next step in the sales process, and then we follow up, and then maybe they want us to sharpen our pencil, you know, get the price down a bit. Who knows? There's some negotiation going on. And then there's a yes or no decision. And then maybe it's at that point, we get the order, we don't get the order. So people need to start looking at their sales as a process. What are the fundamental steps that you take your clients through from the very beginning to the very end where you get a yes? That's your sales process. And it might be 5 steps, 20 steps, whatever. What I recommend is to map it out. You know, let's get a big piece of paper on the wall and say, "Okay, what's the very first thing we do in our sales process? How do we contact them? What's our marketing channels we use? Do we use a website? Do we use social media? Do we go to conferences? Do we network? Do we ask for referrals? What are all those things that we do that generate a potential a lead for us so we can talk to a potential client? And once we get a lead, maybe we're at a trade show and we got a business card. How do we convert that lead into a yes? You know, what are all the steps we take our prospective clients through so we can get a yes?" And usually it's not really mapped out very well. And each of those steps along the way are not really well documented. And people just have a tendency to drift. And God forbid there might be an objection. You know, objections happen all the time. And so how do we handle, "Well, your price is too high," or "My brother's cousin's uncle does that, and, you know, I can get that also being done, you know, by not somebody else," or "I need to think about it, you know, can you call me later?" You know, there's all these objections that happen in the sales process also. So I think one of the things I'd love to see companies doing is what I've started doing is actually coaching them through creating a formalized sales process that everybody can follow. Each of those steps is documented. What do we say? How do we say it? How do we make it compelling? And that alone can have a significant impact on just creating more yeses. And if we can get more yeses, you know, we can grow our top line.
Very good. So number one is to map out the sales process?
Yes. Map out your entire sales process. Figure out, you know, how do you go to market? What are your marketing channels? Start at the very top of the sales process, what I call the sort of the marketing channels. Is it website? Is it RFPs, RFQs? Is it referrals? Is it networking? I mean, what are the tentacles that you're using to go out there to let people know you exist in the world? And then those things should generate some sort of an opportunity. Once you get a prospective client, how do you guide them through your steps all the way till you get a yes? And what I often see is when you map this out, Tony, you end up with some speed bumps because they glare at you and say, "We get stuck right there every time. Every time we get to the objection about, you know, your price is too high, we fold our cards, we discount our price, and it hurts us." You know, so what are the things that we can do to really look at all the steps in the way we sell and improve them? So put a flow chart together on the wall, and it should identify some key things can be improved.
Excellent. Okay. So we have a visual flow chart on the wall with everything ferreted out, ironed out, sorted out, and key people are in agreement. Yes, this is the way we want to do it.
Exactly. And those things are documented, and you're going to follow it, and you'll find that people feel more confident in what they're doing. You know, it's kind of called walking the window. Step your client through your sales process. Have it in your mind. You know, visually have that first step, I've got to do this, and here's what I've got to say. And second step, I need to say this. And actually, as you get better and better at it, you'll see more yeses and you'll close more business, and confidence will go up. because you've got that nailed down from end to end. And imagine when you hire a new employee, how cool would it be to say, okay, let's go through some training on how to really get this to go. And they get out there after the training program on how do we sell, and they have a better success too.
I love it. Brilliant. Awesome. All right, John, what's number two, please?
Okay, number two is inconsistent quality. Okay, so think about quality in terms of getting it right the first time. That's really what quality control is. And, you know, with a lack of quality control, you know, it can cause all kinds of problems. Imagine that we're making bicycle frames, for instance. I had a company that made bike frames, and a client wanted a particular type of paint job on the bike frame. So the tube cutting department would take the tubes, the raw material, and they cut the frame, the tube down to certain sizes for certain parts of the frame. Then they would send it to the welding department, and the welding department would weld it. And then they sent it to the grinding department, and the guys would grind the welds nice and smooth so you can't see them. And the final step was sort of a powder coat, you know, finishing line. But by the time it got inspected, they'd look at it and go, you know what? There's something wrong here. It's not right. And by that point, it's too late. We can't fix it. You know, we have to scrap it. We have to throw the whole thing away, you know, and start over. So quality control is sort of like an internal step-by-step passing the baton from one person to the next to the next. So what we did is we said, okay, look, we got to make these bike frames right. We can't have them being inspected at the end and there's something wrong with them. So what we did is we created a quality control process that was from department to department. So for instance, the guys that cut the metal, raw metal parts, they would cut the parts and then they would send them to the welding department. And the welding department would look at these and goes, you know what? These aren't right. I'm not going to spend the time to weld these because the frame's not going to weld properly. So they sent them back to the cutting department, which forced the cutting department to get it right the first time. They were their own internal quality control, like an internal customer. You know, from cutting to welding was two customers. And I said to the company, I said, look, what happens if you just cut the metal and you outsource the welding? So the guy across the street, you know, you load up the cut metal parts and he's going to weld it up or she's going to weld it up or that company's going to weld it up across the street. And they get these parts in and they start to weld it and it's not right. What's the company across the street that you outsourced it to going to say? And they say, well, they probably ship it back to us and say, I can't weld these. They're not right. Well, then why can't we think in those terms internally also? And then the sort of light bulb went on and goes, okay, so we've got to make sure that if it goes, the batons pass from one department to the other, there needs to be an inspection going on to make sure it's right. They can't accept it otherwise. Because if they do, what they'll do is they'll spend a lot of time fixing it. You know, they'll have to do the work that the cutting department was supposed to do in the first place. And sometimes, you know, the cutting department would do a great job and it would go to the welders and the welders would weld it. And then the grinding department would look at it and say, I can't grind these welds. They're not right. And so they would send them back to the welding department to be fixed. But what happened is over time, people started paying attention. You know, they realize that I got to get it right the first time. I just can't throw it over to the next department and have them fix what I probably should have been doing in the first place. So all this was going on. There was more efficiencies. There was less scrap and waste and rework going on, which is very expensive for companies. Whether it's a manufacturing company or any type of company, whether it's construction that has multiple steps going on in a process, you know, it could be an architect that does the rendering and then they do the final prep and then they do the drawings. You know, whatever it is, there's these internal customers that are going on. But by putting quality control in place, it had a huge impact on efficiency and profitability for companies.
That's excellent, John. Very good. And yes, it is very true. Every department and or area of a company has to treat what comes from another department, division, or whatever, just like they are a customer. Very good point. And it's so obvious when you look at it, of course. But then again, companies don't always do that, do they?
They don't. They're not even thinking. When I say, okay, let's talk about your quality control process. What's in place? You know? And the answer is, what's quality control? And so we've got to start thinking in those terms of how do I have a QC checkpoint going on all the way through from the, maybe from, you know, there's quality control in our sales process, maybe, You know, the types of documents we send, proposals, are those checked to make sure they're high quality? So quality really needs to become kind of a way of life inside a company. And I find that those companies that are quality focused, you know, like Ford's got, you know, this slogan, you know, Ford's quality one, whatever. You know, it's true, though. You know, it's a helpful, you know, a huge company like Ford Motor Company focus on quality. Companies like Toyota and Sony and Honda have been living in focused on the quality of what they do, the reliability and quality of their products. And, you know, actually, Japanese auto manufacturers and even German manufacturers like Mercedes and BMW, I mean, they're building really high quality cars because they're reliable and people want to buy them. The fact of the matter is, if you look at the studies, the American automotive companies are as reliable as the German and the Japanese, but there's a perception that those cars are better. I want to get a Honda versus a Chevy because it's still that belief that maybe it's not quite right. And so I'm going to get stranded on the middle of the highway in the middle of nowhere. You know, I need a quality car. So quality is really critical for companies. And I find that if they focus on putting a quality control system in place, it has a big impact on efficiencies and profitability.
Very good points, John. Thank you. And yes, it is perceived as far as the cars, but that's for another time, I guess. But yes, very good. Excellent points. All right, number three, please.
So this one is, so here's my question. What is a Big Mac and an F-15 have in common?
All right. Trick question. What's the answer, John?
Okay. So first off, they're both fast.
You can't eat both.
They both have lots of grease, and they'll probably both kill you, but that's not what they have in common. And what they have in common is that they have a standardized written procedure on how they're made. So let's take the Big Mac, for instance, right? I mean, millions of these things are sold all over the world every day, right? So let's just say that, Tony, you know, you don't like pickles, and I don't like that middle bun. It's just, I don't like it. So we're going to go in the back, and we're going to make the burger the way we want to, and we're going to put it in a box, and we're going to give it to customers. What's that going to do to the customer experience as somebody drives through and gets this Big Mac that doesn't have the pickles or doesn't have the middle bun? What's going to happen to that customer experience?
You know, because of the name and the quality that they provide in one area, especially like McDonald's and so forth, you know that wherever you go in the world, you are going to get the exact same thing. You know the taste, you're prepared for it, you know the quality. When I went to McDonald's in France, I knew exactly what I was going to get, exactly the taste. When I was in Greece in Athens and I went to a McDonald's, I knew exactly what to take. It's the same all over the world. It's that dependability.
Exactly. So how do we get that dependability? How do we have because if you don't like pickles or you like lots of pickles and I don't like that middle bun, what's going to happen is it's going to change the customer experience. It's not going to be consistent. And therefore, you know, one time you drive through, it's got too many pickles. And one time you drive through, it's got no cheese and the middle bun's missing. I mean, you're going to start wondering what's going on here, right? People have a tendency to like consistency. They don't want to be surprised, you know, in a bad way anyway. What happened is McDonald's actually started writing standard operating procedures, which is a standard way of doing something. So the way they make the Big Mac is consistent. You know, it's 2L beef patty, special sauce, lettuce, cheese, so on and so forth. And they assemble it exactly the same way all around the world every single time. And they enforce the procedure. They make sure that if that doesn't look like a Big Mac, it's not going out the door. We cannot sell it. You know, if we burn the bun or the fries aren't right or the shake's a little watery or whatever we're selling, it has to be meet exact standards of what we're doing every single time. And, you know, so McDonald's is able to build their entire worldwide model around this idea of standard operating procedures. So the way we greet the customer, clean the store, open the store, close the store, you know, switch from breakfast to lunch, so on and so forth. All those things are standardized. And the most successful McDonald's operators are the ones that follow the procedures to the T. It's also interesting is that a lot of mom and pop restaurants fail within the first 5 years, where 90% of franchise operations like McDonald's are still in business 5 years later. And I think that the difference between success and literally failure is having standard operating procedures in place. So for instance, standard operating procedures are really cool because they're really a written document on how to do something, how to greet the customer, fill out the paperwork, clean the machine, you know, whatever it is you're doing. And what's really cool about that is that you end up having an operations manual that everybody then follows. So you have high quality consistency. And that's what McDonald's built their entire model on. So they were able to scale their business and open up multiple locations because they had the systems like checklists, like training videos, like a flow chart, you know, all kinds of different things they put together that made standard procedures really successful. I mean, for me, when I had the Roasted Nut Company, and I didn't know anything about standard operating procedures but at the time, but I started growing, and I started going from one arena to the next, to Universal, to Disney, you know, all around the places, all around the world. And it forced me to say, how do I get this under control? Because if I don't have every batch of almonds perfect, then we're going to have a problem. Because when you're dealing with high heat, you know, in candy making and sugar, I mean, 5 or 10 seconds left or right, you've got a raw almond or you've got a burnt one. And so how do I get this down to a science where everybody can have the perfect cinnamon glazed almond every single time? And so I wrote it down on a step-by-step, step one, step two, step three. Here's what you do exactly every single time. So I took the guesswork out of it and actually had like a checklist I put on the machine that people could read and follow. Even if they made 100 batches, they still can read it and follow it. You know, I had a way, how do we greet the customer every single time? You know, how do we, make the cart look the same and look same feel and look and same customer experience? So I was doing kind of all those standard operating procedures without really even knowing that. One day I read about SOPs and, gosh, that's what I've been doing. But that's what helped me grow from one location to hundreds around the world. And I think that was one of the key things in terms of getting the company to be one of the 500 fastest growing companies, because SOPs took the guesswork out.
That's brilliant, John. It's like also like an icon or a logo. It's the same. It's consistent. The logo for a company doesn't change when it's in another country. It's the same. And it's sort of in the same way your cart, that logo, that icon looks the same no matter where that customer is. And he'll see whether your umbrella is a different color, different type. He could see it from a distance and know exactly what it is and the taste and what to expect and so forth. So that's brilliant.
It really helped me. I mean, it made a huge difference. I think it was one of the key things that I became scalable. You know, everybody talks about scalability, but really what I think, and that's kind of a weird word, but what it really means to me is how do I go from 1 to 2 to 10 to 100 and so on in terms of growth of your business, in terms of locations? It's through SOPs. And I look at so many cool concepts. You know, I see so many businesses that, you know, you've got one great concept going. You know, it's some cool Asian Chinese thing or some Brazilian thing or whatever it might be. It's a really cool concept. And I ask the owner, you know, do you want to expand this thing? And they're like, well, I'd love to, but I can't be in two places at once. I'm like, exactly. That's why you need standard procedures. And the only way you're going to grow from 1 to 2 to 10 to 100 and really build an amazing business is through this concept of standardization through procedures.
I love it, John. Very cool. All right. Number four, please.
Scheduling, scheduling, scheduling. I mean, you know, we have to schedule things. We got scheduled delivery. We got scheduled for projects. We got schedules going on all the time. Production scheduling. I mean, how do we get a handle on scheduling? And what I find quite often is when we really dive into the whole scheduling thing, what I feel like is like the customer can control the schedule. And that can be a problem. Now, clearly, you know, the squeaky wheel will get the grease. Customers might call and say, where's my delivery? Where to go? I need it yesterday. And the reality is that it wasn't really due until next week. So imagine 100 customers with 100 deliveries, 100 things going on at the same time. How do you sort of schedule things? How do you make sense of it all? And what I find is that scheduling can be a real issue, and making sure that the customer gets what they want on time when they want it. That's the main thing. If we can't get there, we're going to continue to have problems. So one of the techniques that I like to use for scheduling is called I freeze the schedule, which means that the schedule's not changing. And I don't care if the salesperson calls the production manager and says, you know, I don't care what you're doing, ship that out today. And the production manager's like, yeah, well, that's not due for 3 days from now. It's got to go out the door today. Now, what that does is that imagine just throwing a wrench in a machine. I mean, can you imagine just what's that going to do to the machine? It's running, but now we toss a wrench in it. That's kind of what happens. So there has to be some really good, clear communication on getting your scheduling down. And sometimes you have to say to the sales guy, you know what? It's not due for 3 days, and we're not shipping it out for 3 days. Because if we do, we've got to stop everything we're doing. It throws our entire current customers off because they're going to be now late, and so on and so forth. So freezing the schedule can be a really important thing. It takes guts to do it. Now, if it's an emergency situation, there's always caveats, right? You know, the customer immediately ran out of the blue product and we got to ship in the blue one because they're out and their whole production line's down or whatever. You know, that can happen from time to time. But, you know, because it's an emergency on their part necessarily doesn't mean it's an emergency on our part either. So we might want to look at, you know, how do we communicate better with the customer to know what the schedule is? And I know schedules can change. I know, I'm sure there are people listening to me that do scheduling and going, yeah, but that's not going to work because the customer calls, we got to ship it. Well, check to see if it's actually that critical, you know, because the customers always want it yesterday. You know, I'm sure you've heard that, Tony, right?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, scheduling is predictability. And take it to a brick and mortar. You know, let's say a business opens at 9 a.m. and closes at 9 p.m. Customers know that that's when they're open and they expect it, they predict it, and there's no shock and there's no issue. But then, you know, just you go to Italy, stores will close whenever they want for whatever reason. It throws out the predictability and creates a bit of frustration as well.
That's true. It's true. You know, it's not just scheduling the production schedule, but it's, you know, scheduling people, you know. You know, let's say you've got a restaurant, you know, and you've got, you know, when is the right time to have the servers come in? Do they come in right when we open, when we have no customers? Or maybe they need to come in at, you know, let's say we open at 4:30, but we're really not busy until about 6. Is it worth kind of scheduling them? Maybe I have one server coming at 4:30 just in case we get busy, but then another server comes in at 5:30, another one at 6:30. So it really helps you manage your labor costs through scheduling also. You know, do I send the busboy homes early? Various things like that. Do I need the prep cook to get there at the same time every day based on what we've got in the kitchen? So, I mean, things can change around. But it's all about really, scheduling is all about saving resources, saving material, saving time, saving money, saving overtime, you know, saving on payroll. So look at your scheduling process. I think a lot of companies that might listen to this might think it's hard, but it's really not. One technique I've always found very successful at going, freeze the schedule. Don't let the salespeople dictate really what the schedule is going to be. And unless it's a complete emergency, but that'll help immediately save money for companies.
Very good and very true, very true. Well, thank you on that. All right, there's so much information here that we didn't want to cut down this interview, so we made two parts for you. I'm sure you want to listen to someone whose company made $100 million in revenue, right? Please listen to episode 100. Part 2 of John Mautner discussing the top tools to build a profitable, high-growth business right here on Revenue Chat. Thanks again, everyone, and until next time, remember, you can make life better for yourself and everyone. Choose wisely.